excellent news, everybody. The Cold War is over. For those of us who just, you know, didn't buy the whole Berlin Wall coming down thing or the collapse of the Soviet Union thing, it is now officially official. But I don't want to steal the credit here. Here is President Bush while meeting with Russian President Putin last Friday.
We spent a lot of time in our relationship trying to get rid of the Cold War. It's over. It ended.
That's good news. All in all, pretty good weekend for the president. Met with Vladimir, declared the Cold War over, probably walked Barney. So now that that's to bed, let's turn our eyes to Russia. What? Again? Yes. Yes. Our next guest says that the danger posed by bomb-making materials left over from the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 is very, very real. Lawrence Scott Sheets has written an article in the April issue of The Atlantic about small-time crooks caught smuggling weapons-grade uranium. Hi, Lawrence. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Aren't you glad to hear that the Cold War is over?
I'm glad to hear. I think that must be at least the 15th time that I've heard it, but I guess we keep having to emphasize it.
Well, it's worth celebrating. So, Lawrence, after the Soviet collapse, basically 22,000 tactical nuclear weapons and 1,200 tons of bomb-grade uranium were what? Left unattended? Put on the sidewalk?
Well, perhaps not put on the sidewalk, but there had always been concerns about the safety of former Soviet nuclear stockpiles in the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union because of the very poor state of the economy. Many scientists were out of work. There were anecdotal reports about security guards walking away from nuclear installations. We don't know if those types of things are true, but all through the 1990s and to this day, there's still a tremendous amount of concern about the safety of all of these facilities, which were highly secret and about which we still know very little.
Now, your article focuses primarily on a small-time smuggler who was caught in Georgia with 100 grams of highly enriched uranium in his pocket, in his Ziploc sandwich bag. So who is this guy, Lawrence, and how the heck did he get his hands on uranium?
His name is Ali Kintsagov. He's an interesting individual because I think he sort of encapsulates what happened to many men after the breakup of the Soviet Union. He'd been a car mechanic. He had been a truck driver during the Soviet period. Fell on hard times, as many men did, and it became impossible for people to make a regular living through their wages, which were given to them by state institutions. A lot of these jobs simply ceased to exist, and people turned basically to wheeling and dealing. They turned to selling whatever they could get their hands on. Many friends of mine, acquaintances of mine, were taking trips from this country where I am right now, Georgia, or from Russia, and going to Turkey, buying up cheap things in Turkey, bringing them back, for instance, to Russia and reselling them. Kintsagov dabbled in things like sausage. He dabbled in fish. He dabbled reportedly in cheap Turkish chandeliers, lighting, whatever he could buy and sell and make a small profit at. At some point, he began trading in furs. We know that, and he was taking trips to Siberia, Siberia also being the location of all of these, this vast network of the Russian nuclear complex. So how he actually came into contact, who his contacts were in the nuclear world, we don't know exactly. He was so afraid, Ali Kintsagov, apparently, of the people who had supplied him that he refused even to name any first names of these individuals to the Georgian authorities. He could have invented some generic names. He didn't have to go into detail. But he was evidently so terrified of whoever he got this material from that he didn't even bother to name them. So he was a guy who was your basic wheeler dealer and saw an opportunity to make a few dollars smuggling some highly enriched uranium, which, yes, could be used potentially to power a fissionable nuclear weapon.
Will you put this in perspective? He was apprehended with about 100 grams. How much is that? How much do you need to make a bomb?
There are varying estimates. It depends on the sophistication of the persons trying to assemble a bomb. The lowest sort of estimate that is around there generally is from 8 to 10 kilos you would need, and that would be for a very highly sophisticated state actor. Now, if you were somebody who perhaps didn't have nearly as much technical expertise, you would need much more than that, perhaps in the range of 40 to 50 kilos. So what he had wasn't that much, but he said that he had quite a bit more. And we don't know how many Ali Kinsagovs there are out there who were never arrested and who managed to peddle this highly enriched uranium to their buyers.
Lawrence, do you think the Russians know where the material is coming from? What was your sense of that when you started questioning people?
Well, this is very interesting because I obtained a document which came from the former KGB, which had been sent to the Georgians, where the Russians claimed that they didn't know where this material came from because it was too old. Now, any nuclear physicist will tell you the age has nothing to do with it. You can do tests, basically, to establish the origins of the material. So what it looked like at first really was a cover-up, a classic cover-up, where the Russians probably knew exactly where this stuff was coming from because all highly enriched uranium is supposedly entered into logbooks. No two batches are the same. It's like when you take fingerprints, when a policeman takes a fingerprint. Every single batch is different. So what looked like a cover-up really sort of changed in the course of reporting the story over a year when I began to speak with significant people and experts in the nuclear nonproliferation field who told me just about how bad the situation was with the security of Russian nuclear materials. And their theory was more that it could also be that they really don't know where it is coming from. They know that it's Russian, but they don't know which institute or installation it came from because we never really knew how much material Russia had, how much of this highly enriched uranium Russia had in the first place. So if you don't know how much you had in the first place, you don't know what went missing.
So that also
may be the case.
Yeah, both scenarios are scary. If they do know, means they're not telling us to present an embarrassing or, you know, Armageddon-like situation. And if they don't know, then it means all our efforts to contain nuclear materials have essentially failed, right?
Well, that's a very bleak assessment, but I happen to think it's a very accurate one, unfortunately.
It's Monday.
Yeah.
Sorry. All right. Well, you were saying that we don't know how many Oleg Kintsagovs are out there. Georgian authorities caught two other smugglers with uranium in the past 5 years, and they were also basically, like Kintsagov, petty crooks. Scary question, though. What about people who have a lot of money to throw around, you know, who are organized, who have the incentive to build weapons that can kill as many people as possible?
Well, I mean, this is the very scary aspect of it. None of these three individuals who you mentioned were particularly well-educated people. They had no ties to any sort of scientific background or any specific interest in nuclear materials. They just happened to be three what sound like to be rather down on their luck middle-aged guys who had been trading this and trading that and engaging in petty smuggling and failed business ventures. Now, the question which you ask about what about somebody who is highly, first of all, sophisticated, well-funded, doesn't do stupid things like discussing these issues openly over the telephone, doesn't tell his smuggling buddies in Georgia, would you like some highly enriched uranium, doesn't use functioning border points. If you think about that, it's very scary because somebody who's highly motivated and was able to take advantage of all of the holes in the system which existed in the 1990s and continue to exist in large measure today in many former Soviet states, anybody who took advantage of these things, you'd have to come to believe that they probably would have been able to, they would have gotten away with it. The fact that these individuals were apprehended, were arrested, I mean, they were practically screaming to be arrested.
Right. The U.S. has had quite a large role in trying to contain the former Soviet Union's nuclear materials, and we still spend $1 billion per year trying to keep track of it all. Is the U.S. officially concerned about this?
Of course, there are official statements of concern all the time. People like former Senator Sam Nunn, who now has dedicated his life to the control of nuclear materials from the former Soviet Union and trying to get Russian and American scientists together and set up all of these programs to try and control these materials. You know, there are statements of commitment that we realize the gravity of the situation. We realize how dangerous this is. But there's a lack of follow-through in the middle levels of the bureaucracies in both countries. There are so many other problems. We've become so preoccupied with Al-Qaeda and with terrorism and with Iran and North Korea. And the story's sort of gone off the radar screen. And quite frankly, the eventualities are still quite a bit scarier than some of the things which we've been focusing on, because right now one of the big issues over the last year has been whether Iran will be able to produce centrifuges, which could eventually produce small amounts of highly enriched uranium, when we know that there's tons of the stuff in Russia, and we don't know really what kind of security conditions a lot of them are under.
Lawrence, why do you think that is?
A lot of these things are news-driven. They're driven by today's news story. I think there's a fatigue in general with stories about Russia. It's been 20 years of, 20 years since the Soviet Union started collapsing. It's not on the front, it's not on the front burner every day, so people start to forget about it until you have a situation where some petty smuggler gets caught with highly enriched uranium, and people start asking a lot of questions about the degree of cooperation between the U.S. and Russia over this, and just how secure these materials are.
I'm glad you're writing a story on it. I mean, Iran and North Korea could just go to Russia if they really wanted the materials, right?
Theoretically, that's perhaps absolutely the case. I think less so in the case of North Korea. But in the case of Iran or other groups, I think there's less concern about state actors than there are about rogue groups wanting to obtain this material. But yes, theoretically, if you were able to assemble enough people who were to go to Russia or have contacts in Russia or develop them over the course of many, many years, it would be theoretically possible to assemble the type of materials which you need. You wouldn't need to make it yourself, and that's the scary part.
So nuclear terrorism possible?
I would defer to people like, again, Sam Nunn on this. Senator Sam Nunn was posed a question recently. He was asked, what are the chances that terrorists could build a so-called suitcase bomb, nuclear bomb, fissionable device? We're not talking about a dirty bomb, which really has more scare value than anything else. And he put the chances at a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10, which I think is not very encouraging. So the American experts in this field tend to think it's entirely possible. It's just not something I think that the Russians want to contemplate, many of them, especially on a political level.
Lawrence, you've been talking to us from Georgia, is that right?
That's correct.
All right, well, if things get dire and there's an inevitable Armageddon, is that where you want to be? Or would you like to be in Hawaii or something?
Huh. Well, this is a pretty far out of the way place. I think I would want to be in some place like Greenland or perhaps on Easter Island or perhaps Antarctica. Those would be my top three choices.
You're very practical.
Well, we have to be, don't we?
Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us. They speak Russian in Georgia, right?
No, Georgia has its own language, which they're very proud of, which is much older than the Russian language, actually. But most people do speak Russian as well here from having spent 70 years in the Soviet Union.
I was going to say spasiba, but I don't speak Georgian. I mean, I'm from Atlanta, so I'll just say thanks, y'all.
I can teach you how it is in Georgian. You say gmadlopt.
Maglopt?
Oh, it's beautiful. That was perfect.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can find out more about Lawrence Scott Sheets' article for The Atlantic on our website, morefairgame.org.